Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, September 16, 2016. Former lost boys and girls from South Sudan say they are ready to help their country.
Because we were very few that we just went there and we disappeared. You know, we were blending in the system. So if this bill gets passed, it would be very nice if it is passed, because it will be the backbone of diaspora knowledge transfer to South Sudan.
And the governor of former Western Equatoria State says foreign troops are poaching in his state.
We got forces called Seleka, and they are still poor. We have forces of Janjaweed. They are still controlling half of Central Africa. There are LRA forces also with them.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. As we told you yesterday, a law to help rebuild South Sudan by funding the return of hundreds of former lost boys and girls was introduced this week in the U.S. Congress. One U.S. lawmaker says she hopes her colleagues will focus on rebuilding South Sudan so that when peace and stability finally returns to the country, the U.S. will be better positioned to help. But as Ayen Bior reports for VOA from Washington, the legislation is by no means close to final approval.
The bill is now before the House Committee on Foreign Affairs, where lawmakers are reviewing it and deciding whether to vote it out of committee so it can be debated by the full House. Democrat Karen Bass from the West Coast state of California is urging her colleagues to vote in favor of the bill because it is consistent with the ongoing work the U.S. government is doing on behalf of the people of South Sudan.
You should know this is not the only thing that's happening around South Sudan. We're talking about this right now. There's other legislative efforts that we're looking at. But in my opinion, focusing on people here returning home is exactly what we should be doing. You don't just want to, and this is what Congress typically does, Congress focuses on putting out fires. We want to focus on building.
Bass knows that it could take months, sometimes even years, before a bill becomes law. A clause in the bill states that the State Department must declare that South Sudan is safe enough for the former lost boys and girls to return in order for them to do their work. Mayombula Chuk, a former lost boy who came to the U.S. in late 2000, says he thinks the bill could open up more options for people like him who are eager to go back.
I thought like that would be the best way to go and connect with the land and with the people in South Sudan since I left at the younger age.
Bull returned to South Sudan in 2013 after earning two master's degrees, one in Christian leadership and the other in international development at Eastern University in the town of St. David's, located in the East Coast state of Pennsylvania. Bull says he wanted to use both degrees and experience toward helping South Sudanese citizens, but before he could do that, the conflict erupted in late 2013. The United States eventually evacuated citizens, including Bull himself. Despite fears of insecurity, Bull remains hopeful this time around because the bill introduced this week will make a difference. Apajo Dao Deng, who was just 15 years old when she came to the United States in 2000, lives and works as a banker in Richmond, Virginia, about 2 hours' drive time south of Washington, D.C. She says she wants to go back to South Sudan to mentor and encourage young women.
We need as much educated women as possible. You know, we need to educate women that is not just only to get married as soon as they turn 16, but follow what's your life, you know, what you're supposed to do or what your life will be.
Jacob Rye, another former lost boy who received a certificate in information technology at a training facility called New Horizons in Pennsylvania, says he wants to go back to teach South Sudanese how to use computers. He says he knows that the bill has a long way to go before it becomes law, but he is convinced that providing transportation for South Sudanese diaspora to go back to their home country is the best way to help develop South Sudan.
And you can build a country based on just only physical infrastructure. You do need, you know, human capital, but we are part of that community, and we hope and we feel that we can contribute, you know, like other people back home. And most of us here do believe that if we go back, then we will build the country that way.
If a majority of lawmakers on the House Foreign Affairs Committee approve the bill and it passes in the full House, the legislation will be referred to the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, where it will move through the same process, and if approved, will land on the president's desk for signature. Bass says she expects it will take several months for the process to move forward. In the meantime, she's hoping peace returns to South Sudan. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
America's policy on refugees has become a political football in the past year, thanks to a global immigration crisis, fears of terrorist attacks, and a combative presidential election. Steve Baragona reports on America's increasing conflicted attitudes towards refugees.
Unlike these refugees headed for Western Europe, U.S.-bound asylum seekers don't just show up on American shores. To resettle in America, applicants are carefully screened and go through multiple security checks, a process that often takes up to 2 years. Mark Storella is with the State Department's Bureau of Refugees and Migrants.
The point I want to make most strongly is that refugees are the most thoroughly screened travelers to the United States of anyone coming to this country.
But that's not what most Americans hear.
And now I hear we want to take in 200,000 Syrians, right? And they could be, listen, they could be ISIS. I don't know.
Talk like that feeds American fears. But refugee advocate Lavinia Limon says it has no basis in fact. She heads one of the largest refugee resettlement agencies in the United States.
None of the 9/11 terrorists were refugees. None of the folks that have done bad things in America or Paris or any place else in the last few years have been refugees.
However, with fears of terrorist attacks atop most Americans' minds, admitting refugees from Syria and elsewhere has become a political football in this country.
Certainly, I have not seen in the last 40-something years that I've working with refugees this kind of politicization, using them really as an issue, but in the presidential campaign. That is new.
Last year, Trump was joined by fellow Republican candidates, members of Congress, and more than two dozen governors in calling for a halt to admitting Syrian refugees. President Obama dismissed those calls, and in response to criticism that the U.S. wasn't doing enough to ease the global migration crisis, ordered his administration to ramp up the number of refugee admissions to the U.S. to 85,000 this year. And next year, the administration said this week, it will admit 110,000 refugees, the largest number in two decades. For VOA correspondent Masood Farivar, I'm Steve Baragona.
The governor of Budoe State says a number of armed groups, including Nigeria's Islamist group Boko Haram and the Darfur-based Janjaweed militia, are operating in his state. Governor Patrick Raphael Zamoi says the groups are wreaking havoc in the area. Tito Justin has more for VOA from Juba.
Beside Boko Haram and Janjaweed, Governor Zamoi says Ugandan Lord's resistance army are also operating in South Sudan. Speaking in Arabic last night to lawmakers in the Council of States, South Sudan's upper house of parliament, Zamoi said at least five different vigilant groups have bases in the newly created Budoe State.
We got forces called Seleka. The Seleka came from Chad, and they are still poor. We have forces of Janjaweed. They are still controlling half of Central Africa. There are LRA forces also with them. We also have the forces that defected from a will called Tawarikh Rebel. They are with them. We also have the Boko Haram forces from Nigeria. All these five groups are together in one place.
Zamoi accuses the armed groups of stealing South Sudanese natural resources, including wildlife, and exporting them illegally to their home countries.
They come up to Garamba Park, killing elephants and going away with their tusks, and go to Kafia Genje, where there is an airstrip and planes land there. What we learn is that they are taking them to China.
The Uganda People Defense Force, UPDF, and American Special Forces are deployed in parts of the former Western Equatorial State to hunt down LRAF fighters. Zamoi claims Ugandan and American soldiers deployed in the area are doing nothing to expel the vigilant groups.
We have forces of UPDF at the border of Central Africa and the American forces, but they are unable to pursue the rebel groups.
Governor Zamoi says he fears the groups will pose a major security threat not only in the greater Western Equatorial region, but across the country. Military spokesman Brigadier General Lul Rai Kong says he is yet to receive information about the armed groups.
I'm yet to get in touch with our field commander, and because I have not yet gotten in touch, I would not want to comment on what was made public by the state authority.
Parts of former Western Equatoria state became insecure last year following the outbreak of fighting between government forces and the Arrow Boys, as well as other unknown militia groups. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Tonj, where traders dealing in money transfers say their business are crumbling because the mobile phone networks on which they rely to communicate with clients have broken down. Some residents complain that they can neither send or receive money from relatives who live far away. Mobile phone operators say they are unable to provide services to some areas because of technical challenges and insecurity. Gwen Utten has this story for VOA.
For more than a week, Tonjtown residents have had no phone communication after VivaCell, the only remaining mobile operator in the area, shut down its operations. Traders dealing with mobile money transfer services have suffered greatly. They rely solely on telephone networks to communicate with clients who receive or send money to relatives and friends across South Sudan. Longhart Dang works for the Kwanjuk Money Transfer Company. He says the poor network has created mistrust between companies and customers.
For example, the client may come and say, I have a message. And if you go on through the notes, you may not find the written message. The client may quarrel with the one who is working in the company that it might be some kind of hiding the thing.
Dang says the government needs providers to explain the poor services. He says if the situation continues, most local mobile money transfer companies will close down their shops in the two towns. James Malok of Wanhelel Money Transfer Company says the main problem is that people cannot communicate, and that makes it impossible to confirm whether or not money has been sent.
All the customers have come and they don't get their money because they don't have any way to communicate with their people so that they can know there is money which has been transferred to them or there's no money. For the network crisis, we receive more than 100 calls a day, but nowadays it reduced to 30.
Malok says before the crisis, he was able to pay the rent for his premises as well as the salaries for his staff and still made a decent profit. But the way things are going now, Malok says he might be forced to close down the shop. Santo Aluang is a civil servant with the Tong state government whose family resides in Kwajok. Aluang says sending money to his family and communicating with them has become a nightmare.
Our salary as civil servant has spent some time, 3 to 2 months, without getting them. So when you get money, it is again difficult to send them because network problem is affecting us. Like now, I'm in the bank, a local bank called Wanhelel. We have already sent my minister in morning at 8.
Aluang says not being able to talk to his family members makes him uneasy and makes it difficult to concentrate at work. Justin Luang Mador, the chairman of the Tong State Workers' Trade Union, says money transfer services are not the only sector affected.
This network has also affected the social status of our people because most of our workers here in the state, they have their relatives in places in other states like Wau, Kwajog, and even in Juba. Others are also having their relatives in the diaspora, but they cannot get connected with them simply because there's no network in an area. So this one really is a great setback to our civil population in this state.
Maduro urges state officials and mobile phone operators to work together and find a permanent solution to the network problem in the area. Madit Malek Akwen is Ton State Minister of Information and Telecommunications.
Roads are not well between Juba and Ton, and it is difficult for fuels to be available in the market or to be available to the stations. So some of the stations broke down because there is no fuel. The other issue is the issue of generators. The generators that are operating here are the old generators that were brought since the establishment of this network in the state, and have never been changed. So it happened that they break down from time to time. And sometimes to get a spare part to fix the generator is very difficult.
Stephen James, one of MTN's managers in Juba, says insecurity has also caused problems for operations in Tonj and other areas of Bahal al-Ghazal.
We hope for the peace. If there is a peace, both will be good. And even we can bring a lot of equipment, and then we can upgrade all those sites so that can be good for them.
James says local community and government officials and network operators must work together so people can have reasonable expectations of mobile phone service in the area. This report was prepared by Santino Manute in Tonj. I'm Gwen Uten in Washington.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, school children as young as 7 take to the streets in Malawi. We'll tell you why.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what's the most interesting conversation you've had recently with a friend?
We were talking about the laptops that the president promised to give to all registered university students. So we're kind of wondering whether they are going to reach every student or not, because all students are anxiously waiting for those laptops.
The most interesting conversation was about money. A friend of mine introduced me to a new business where I learned that I can actually make a lot of money without working so hard. And I love money, so it was really interesting.
Interesting conversation that I've had recently with my friend is that he's in a dilemma trying to figure out who to get married to between two ladies. Whom he loves with all his heart, the one who actually has all the qualities that he's looking for in a lady.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. We now turn to Zimbabwe, where a protest movement is growing, but there is no clear leader or single group leading it. Instead, activists have relied on social media to organize and communicate. VOA's Anita Paul has more from Johannesburg, with reporting from Sebastian Muofu in Harare and Bill Eagle in Washington.
The outrage is visible in Zimbabwe, on the streets, but also online. Those inside the movement against longtime President Robert Mugabe say the duality between real-life protests and virtual ones is critical to the movement's success. Opposition politician Tendai Biti spoke to VOA.
They are part and parcel of the hashtag movement. Hashtag Tajamuka, hashtag this flag, hashtag Sesijikile, hashtag this flower, hashtag this hand. And that's the future of this country. That is why I'm making the point that we are in a transition that is both, you know, demographic, some would even say technological. The hashtag generation has found power through the instrumentality of a weapon of mass destruction called the smartphone, and through Twitter, through Facebook, through Instagram.
It's clear that Zimbabwean authorities see the virtual movement as a threat. They've arrested several people, among them the national spokesman of the hashtag Tajamuka, which translates to "We are fed up." 36-year-old Edson Muntasi says he started the hashtag SaveZim to present a true picture of events, contrary to the often rosy tale told by state-owned media.
I hope this message is carried around the world, carried to everybody. Everyone knows what's going on in Zimbabwe, what's really going on the ground.
As if to illustrate his point, the state-owned Herald newspaper has not covered Muntasi's decision to stand on a Harare street corner for more than a week in a public hunger strike. Mugabe, the once-loved liberation leader who has ruled Zimbabwe since 1980, is now facing unprecedented opposition as the economy sinks to new lows. Activist Maureen Kademaunga says she's encouraged by the flourishing of online protests, but wonders, then what?
What worries me the most is that, in as much as there is
unison in terms of what people are discontented about. There is no uniformity in what they want to see done on the Monday morning after Mugabe leaves. And that's really worrying. But I think if he just leaves right now and there is no clear plan as to what should happen, there'll be chaos.
But International Crisis Group analyst Piers Pigou says he isn't sure whether all of Zimbabwe is going along. The street protests have been relatively small, drawing people in the hundreds for the most part. The nation's telecoms regulator said earlier this year that national internet penetration stands at about 48%, hardly a majority.
The extent to which the protest and the hashtag movement are primarily a metropolitan and urban phenomenon is open to question, and I don't think we have a clear picture on that at the moment. But I do think more generally the conditions on the ground, which do not look set to improve anytime soon, are likely to continue to generate more and more protests and dissatisfaction.
Activists say they plan a real-life protest in Harare on Saturday, in defiance of a police ban. The details are all over Twitter. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And school children as young as 7 years old protested in Malawi's capital Wednesday. They urged the government to address the concerns of their teachers who have been on a nationwide sit-in strike since Monday. Lamek Masina reports from Lilongwe.
The children from various schools in the city were protesting on their own without being accompanied by police for escort. Clad in school uniforms, they broke the roads, causing traffic jams in the city streets as they chanted songs calling on the government to meet the teachers' grievances. Then the police intervened and dispersed them before they reached the district education office where they wanted to present a petition. This young protester, who did not want to be named, said students acted on behalf of both themselves and their teachers.
We are fighting for our freedom and education. So it's not right and it's not fair for someone to get educated, become a teacher and not receive his or her money.
The teachers are pushing the government to pay back salaries owed to teachers who were promoted in 2013 and for promotion of other teachers due for advancement. Teachers Union of Malawi Secretary General Dennis Kalekeni says the union has received assurance from the government that it will meet all the teachers' demands by the end of the year. He asked the teachers to resume work and give government the benefit of doubt, although he added a warning.
Once government plays dilly-dally and they think that the suspension can actually give them the audacity to fail to implement, Teachers Union of Malawi shall have no choice but to revive the strike.
Kalekeni repeated the union demands.
We need to see that in September month end, teachers have been uploaded on the payroll for their arrears. We need to see by October that the teachers have been uploaded on grade K.
Education Ministry spokesperson Manfred Ndovi said government officials are committed to meeting the teachers' demands by November. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Lilongwe.
As an albino Cameroonian musician, Ngungwe Ndo Etienne faced resistance when he first took to the stage 30 years ago. But now he's being honored as a trailblazer in the fight to end discrimination against albinos in Cameroon. Muki Edwin Kinzeka has the story for VOA from Yaoundé.
Menge Ondoa Etienne, better known by his stage name Calvino, uses the mvet, a traditional musical instrument popular among the Fang people of Cameroon, Gabon, and Equatorial Guinea to thrill his audience in the Equato-Guinean capital Malabo. He has been invited here by artists from the three countries in recognition of his work to dispel myths about albinos. Calvino says, like other albinos, he grew up ostracized and harassed. At the age of 15, he ran to a policeman for protection, and the policeman called him evil. That was when, he says, he made the decision to use his voice for change.
Au début, on montait dans un taxi, les gens descendaient, on montait dans un bus, les gens descendaient. Et c'est ça qui m'a motivé à fonder l'association des albinos.
He says he would board a taxi or a public bus and people would get off in protest because of his color. He created an association for the defense of albinos called Asmodisa. He says he also wrote to the Malian-born singer, Shelif Keita, with the idea of creating a broader network, and together they founded SOS Albinos. In Cameroon, members of some ethnic groups kill albinos to appease the gods when there are natural calamities. Albinos can also be barred from appearing in public in some areas. Calvino says such perceptions are now changing. A key part of his activism has been performing at schools.
L'albinos ne voit pas loin, n'est-ce pas? Et les écritures qui sont petites sur les épreuves.
He says before, albinos with bad eyesight were kept on back benches in classrooms. But recently, the government of Cameroon has been asking teachers to make texts bigger so albino children can read alongside other children. 15-year-old albino Colette Manga saw Calvino sing at her school when she was young, and it encouraged her to stay in school.
When I was in school, I was ashamed to go in front of the board to take my notes. Some of my friends just shout that, oh, move there, with those eyes who doesn't see. It's on that time that I was just look at myself. I say, oh, really? But in other circumstances, I'm not taking myself like a different person. I'm seeing myself like a black person, a human being. In fact, it's a gift of God. We have to accept ourselves like that.
Cameroon social worker Awemo Patrick says Calvino has had an impact.
I mean, the people in Cameroon who matter, they are now giving the albinos the position they deserve in the society. Meaning, if you're an albino and you are going to school, you deserve a job, they give you the rightful position which you deserve. Through his music, the songs, the message is going across, and the authorities are really taking it seriously.
Calvino says the number of albinos graduating from university is gradually increasing and fewer albino babies are being killed, but he will continue his fight against social injustice. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
And that report by Kinzeka from Yaoundé brings us to the end of our show for this Friday. We now leave you with a remix of the song Vuli Ndela by Brenda Fassi.
Vuli Ndela, pema mpokozi, ye mwenye wami, pelele mwenye sasa. Vuli Ndela, pela manya uta, wadongo.
Been listening to Brenda Fassi with the song Vuli Ndela, which literally means open the way. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Have a safe and restful weekend. Please join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.